there's a lady on the line who, pretty fascinating, she's known as now a whistleblower. We'll find out who she blew the whistle and on what. Her name is Karen Hudes. She was with the World Bank for 21 years as a legal attorney. She has a cat. And is that your cat, Karen Hudes?
Actually, that was my chair, but I have a cat in my lap. The cat is quiet.
Well,
this
see,
was the chair.
I just got your cat by osmosis. Well, that's good. Good morning, Ms. Hudes.
Good morning.
Did they teach you about the real world money, if I can use that term, or this in the Yale Law School?
Well, I went to the University of Amsterdam and studied economics there. I have an MPhil, which is like a PhD without a thesis.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I learned my economics.
And 21 years with the World Bank, hey? Do you think the countries, who owns the cash in the World Bank? I mean, I know that on paper, Karen Hudes, it says that 61 countries or something are involved with the World Bank. But
no, 188.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was close. Halfway there, right?
Right.
But who do you think really holds the key to the vault?
Well, what you see is not what you get. I only found out about who was the power behind the throne, as it were, after I was fired for telling the Congress that there was corruption at the World Bank.
Oh, I bet you they were shocked about that.
No, actually, Senator Lugar was fabulous, fabulous. He wrote three letters to the World Bank saying, don't fire this lady. And the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations at that time was chaired by Joe Biden, and there were two senators on there, our friends Hillary and Barack.
Yeah.
So, and those people were really concerned about the corruption inside the World Bank. That is until, you know, the revolving door. And then the power behind the throne, which is also the power behind the presidency and the executive branch of the federal government, they're the ones that are really trying to run the show. But, you know, all good things have to come to an end. And that's why the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have now, they've read the Riot Act to the World Bank. They said, you know, we don't want these big boys, and I can tell you exactly who they are because of a very good study. Anyway, the BRICS said to these big boys, you know, if you guys aren't going to play by the rules, we're out of here. We're losing patience with you, and we're going to have our own development bank. That's what happened in April. But I had been warning the U.S. Congress for the longest time that this was going to happen, and the way I could warn them is because one of the things the World Bank is it's everybody's bank. You've got these big boys that think they own the world, but they really don't. And they've been read the Riot Act, as I was telling you. But anyway, so this very, very good political scientist, Jacek Kugler, who's at Claremont University in California, anyway, he came to the World Bank and he said, I've got this really neat stakeholder analysis, which if you give me the good numbers, I can tell you pretty accurately what's going to happen. And so I gave him the good numbers on rule of law at the World Bank in 2004. And this very accurate stakeholder analysis predicted that if the U.S. didn't start playing by the rules, we would lose the ability to appoint the president of the World Bank. And I didn't say anything until 2007. I was really trying very hard to get people inside the World Bank to play by the rules because that was my job. I was the lawyer there. Anyway, when that didn't happen, I went to the Treasury Department, and I tried for the longest time to explain to the Treasury Department, and I gave them a copy of this stakeholder analysis. And finally, I came to the conclusion that the Treasury Department was out to lunch, and that was a very unpleasant time. But then I went to Congress. And as I was telling you, I went to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and they understood what I was telling them. By that time, I had been interviewed for the job of general counsel, and the people during the interview said, how come we've got so many general counsels exiting after a couple of years? I said, that's very easy to explain. The World Bank is not in compliance on the capital markets, and the board is very angry that these people are not playing by the rules. And they've had enough of it. And so I know that when you're in an interview for a company which has $180 billion worth of bonds on the capital markets, I know that that problem has to be solved. That's what executive search firms are for, when you've got a publicly traded company.
Wow, a lot there. Karen Udes. So let's see. A lot of this started with something in the Philippines, right?
Actually, no. It didn't start then. It started in the end of the East Asia financial crisis. But before that, I was working on a special project for the board. They were giving extra money to the World Bank. It was something called the Strategic Compact. And that was a deal that the board cut. They said, you're asking us for more money. We want you to improve your management. And they set up a task force, and I was on the Human Resources Task Force. I was representing the Staff Association. And so we recommended that good managers should be promoted and bad managers should be fired, that there should be accountability. And at the end of the exercise, I said, well, wait a minute. We've got good recommendations, but if you're doing reform, you also have to have monitoring of the reform. And if the monitoring goes off track, if it, you know, the reform isn't taking, you have to correct it midstream. And they didn't accept that recommendation. And I got very concerned because I knew it was the right recommendation and the only recommendation. So that's when it really started. That's when I realized that we had something to explain, that what you see is not what you get. And that was at the end of the 90s.
Uh-huh. Did you, in simplistic terms, Karen Hughes, do you think you simply stumbled on the fact that you call them the big boys, and around here we just call them like the boys, right? The people, the power, the money elite that really maybe, well, not maybe, they do own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, you know, the Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan. These are the people that own the bank, Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Not the board, but the bank.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. 100%. So did you just kind of stumble on this and start poking the giant in the eye, so to speak, of the people who really control the World Bank, and then they fired you? Is that in simplistic terms?
No, I'll tell you how it worked. Think of a Polaroid picture that's mm-hmm. developing, and you sort of see things emerging from the murk. That's what happened. I didn't have a clear picture of the big boys in the Federal Reserve until actually a year ago. I mean, I knew that something big and bad was going on because I had done everything that needed to happen, and somebody was intimidating the U.S. Congress. Because after I got fired, three senators asked for GAO to look into corruption at the World Bank, Lugar, Leahy, and Bai, and the World Bank stonewalled that GAO audit. So I knew something big and bad and horrible was happening, but I wasn't sure exactly what it was.
Sure.
But I listened to that interview that you had with Jonathan Macy. I went to Yale Law School as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you know, after the interview, you said, well, gee, he's sort of, you know, making the right noises, but he's not really leveling with me about what's going on here. And I'm with you on that. And I can tell you why I know this very accurately. There's a wonderful analysis that was done by three mathematicians in Switzerland. They had very accurate data on who owns the corporations and who manages the corporations. I think it's 43,000 transnational corporations. And they found out at the end of the exercise that there is something that they call a super entity. We think of four or five banks, forget it. Those guys are all merged together. And we saw that mm-hmm. during the LIBOR scandal, that they're in collusion. It's a conglomerate. And this conglomerate has 40% of the net worth of the companies that are publicly traded, and they have glommed onto 60% of the net earnings on the capital markets. But that's 10 times the power that they really have. They've just done this through clever interlocking directorships. And these big boys are the same ones that control all of the media, because we're talking about a cover-up. The stuff that I was telling Congress immediately should have gone to the public, and it didn't. And it wasn't for lack of trying. I tried desperately. I didn't understand what was going on. I went to all the major newspapers. I've been dealing with these people in different arenas. I didn't realize they were all the same arena, and they were all the same people. I realized it recently.
Well, that's an awakening. So you're talking Washington Post, New York Times, the whole thing?
I am saying that when you turn on a television set, whatever you're seeing has been filtered by those people.
Yes.
So we don't have a democracy here. Not when we, when, what happened during the election, when there were those wonderful looking debates, I went to those guys and I said, you ask those two candidates about international corruption. And they refused. They refused. How can you refuse? Don't forget that Mitt Romney's national security planning chief was the ex-president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick. Robert Zoellick was booted out of there. He was denied a second term deliberately because he was corrupt. And the voters didn't know that Mitt Romney's national security advisor was a crook. And, I wrote a couple of press releases because I couldn't get the papers to tell the voters what they were entitled to know. And don't forget also that there was all this foreign money coming into the campaign from outside the country. So can you talk about a democracy when the voters are blindsided? They don't know who they're voting for, and they're getting all this advertisement. So I wrote a press release saying, I can tell you about who's been helping me all these years, because I've gotten a lot of help from all the countries in the world that are betting on me that I'm going to get through to the people. And that's what I'm doing with this radio show.
So I
had a press release which went to the credit rating agencies. What do you think a credit rating is of a country whose voters are not told about corruption at the highest levels that permeates everything in their whole system? And that's what has been kept from the American voters. This is a massive cover-up. This makes Watergate look like tiddlywinks.
The cover-up exactly is what?
The cover-up is massive corruption. It's something called state capture. Why is it that when Congress, which, don't forget, I was all over them. I went to each one of the people in Congress at various points with their committees, trying to get them to do the right thing. Because one of the things that I learned about this stakeholder analysis was that this wasn't tiddlywinks. And that if the United States people didn't find out about this massive corruption, the whole world was going to hell in a handbasket. We were going to have a currency war. We were going to have a currency war that made what happened in the 30s look like nothing. And I have gotten a lot of help because people recognize the validity of my analysis. And so I have been testifying in the European Parliament. I have had two statements published in the UK Parliament. The UK Parliament's Serious Fraud Office called up the SEC. The Federal Reserve has gained the capital markets. We shouldn't have any investors in there because the Federal Reserve is making money hand over fist on insider trading. This whole country is so corrupt, you can't begin to imagine. And imagine, I can't tell this to the people because the press is owned by those thugs. That's what we're talking about.
Well, that's a lot. 17.
That is a lot.
17 after the hour, Karen Hudes, and she's fired up. Yale Law School, Economics, University of Amsterdam, 21 years at the World Bank. And you can look at her website. It is Karen K.A. Hudes, HUDES.net. Karen Hudes, over the years, we've talked to a lot of different people about all the ideas that these IMF, World Bank, these places can go in and literally create money like the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and then they can loan countries money, like Confessions of the Economic Hitman, you know, this fellow who's written the books about that, where they go into a country and they can buy land and buy power plants and stuff with newly created money, and then they these countries can't pay them back, and then becomes like a blackmail kind of a thing. Is there any way of knowing if the World Bank participates in those kinds of ventures?
I'm familiar with the philosophy on the debt trap, and I think it's fair to say that there are some pretty good projects, and there's some good you get good returns on a good project that'll pay itself back, but there are also some bad projects. And whether the World Bank is putting countries into a debt trap, I think that's a fair question, and I think there has to be some careful analysis done. And so I read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Yeah,
what did you think about that? Do you think he? I mean, he can't be making this stuff up. I don't think.
I'll tell you what I think about it. I think that he is more right than he's wrong. But as I said, you know, you can't paint everybody with a tar brush. And the World Bank has done some real good. I've been part of some really great projects that are owned in the countries. And I've also seen some projects that I was very sorry about. One of the things I wanted to say, though, is that I've been working together with a group of whistleblowers.
Huh.
I'm not just sort of a one-off person. And we have been working very hard and carefully together. We come from all the countries of the world. There's one of us from India. We're not a formal group, but we help each other. We pick each other up when we've been retaliated against. We give each other, you know, pointers about who to watch out for. Some of the people that are offering help are really not offering help. They're offering something quite distinct from help. And then after I got fired, I found my way to a whistleblower in the U.S., and I wanted to mention his name, Mark Novitsky, because you wouldn't be hearing about me if it weren't for Mark. Mark was the one who took me by the hand and showed me which alternative press openings there were so that my story could get out. I mean, this is a massive cover-up. But anyway, getting back to your question, the way I see the World Bank is not as a monolith. The World Bank has a group of very dedicated, this is a dream team, whistleblowers, that want to put the World Bank back on track. It's a co-op of 188 countries. And at the moment, I think the Bretton Woods institutions are absolutely critical to prevent the world from landing in a currency war. We're starting to see some of that. And if it weren't for the Bretton Woods institutions, we wouldn't have the wherewithal to avoid that. And once we have rule of law, which I'm convinced we will have it, after I testified in the UK Parliament, this very accurate stakeholder analysis, which warned us in 2004 that the U.S. would lose its ability to appoint the president of the World Bank. Just, you know, right now it's we can nominate somebody, but our nominee has to compete against other nominees. Anyway, this very accurate stakeholder analysis said that if I didn't get through, Patrick, your listeners don't get alarmed at what they're hearing from me and tell all their friends and go out there and take the rule of law back for this country, the whole world is going to deteriorate into a currency war. But I can tell you, after the break, I was thinking to myself, I gave people a lot to think about. I gave them a lot of bad news, but I didn't give them the good news. I have gone to all of the 50 governors and the 50 attorneys general and the 50 chief justices of the state Supreme Courts, and they all know that we have got to take rule of law back into this country, and we have got to tell those thugs that think they own the place that they do not. And even though those people bought up the press, we in the United States are strong enough morally to take our country back. And even though those thugs own the main media, that isn't going to prevent us from taking our country back. That's the main message I want to give your listeners today.
So the thugs would be, in your opinion, who?
All right. I was telling you about this study in of the mathematicians. There is a super entity of very powerful banks. It's Citibank, it's Goldman Sachs, it's the usual cast of characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that own the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a private bank. It's against the Constitution. And we have a lot of law reform to do. We have a lot of enforcement of our laws. We have new laws we have to enact. We have to see how we landed in the situation that we're in. It's all very doable, but we have got to get very serious because we are on the edge right now. We are on the edge, and we don't have a lot of time. And I can tell you that on the 30th of May, Eric Holder thinks he can throw me in jail. And I want your people who are listening to this to tell their congresspeople to tell Eric Holder where he can get off.
Really? Yes. Eric, you were contacted by the Justice Department?
Okay, I'll tell you how this went. I'm a lawyer, right?
Sure, yeah.
They fired me illegally, totally illegally. And I stayed in touch with all of the countries who are on the board because they knew that I was just their lawyer. And at a certain point, we were talking about what had to happen because, I knew that if we didn't get the rule of law back into the financial system, the world was going to end up in a currency war. So even though personally I wanted to walk away from the problem, I was somebody who I felt if I didn't handle this problem because I understood it so well that nobody else would do it. So I felt obligated. And one of the reasons I had a very good, accurate picture of what was going on is because one of the lawyers who wrote the Articles of Agreement, the World Bank came into existence at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It was to reconstruct Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It was also to, they looked around to see what had gone wrong at the League of Nations, and they set up the World Bank and the IMF in a special way. So you don't have one country, one vote there. What you have is voting that's weighted according to the strength of the economy. So the U.S. has a 16% interest. And anyway, so what I was looking at when I was fired illegally was I was looking at a situation where I had to stay involved and get rule of law. I had no idea who I was up against or how difficult it would be. I thought it was going to be a piece of cake if I had Senator Lugar writing three letters to the World Bank, and the World Bank was in contempt of Congress. I thought, oh, well, this is a piece of cake. I'll be back there the next day. Well, guess what? The U.S. Congress has been swallowed up by those bankers that think they own the world, and they have bought our Congress. They have bought our Congress, and some of our Congress has not been bought. And so those people that were honest put a special provision when the World Bank came to them for money, and don't forget, they stonewalled the GAO investigation. The Congress put a rider in there. They said, we'll appropriate the money, but we won't disperse it until you make your whistleblowers whole. So I figured, okay, I've got a law now. That means that we can solve the problem. Guess what? These people that think they own the world think they're above the law. And so this law is not getting implemented. It's not getting implemented. So when there was this meeting on April 19th, I bought a World Bank bond, which meant that the World Bank was not immune, because I'm not only a fired whistleblower, but I am a bondholder, and I know I'm entitled to accurate information, accurate financial information. And when you fire lawyers who are trying to get the company into compliance on the capital markets, you have a problem with the SEC. So I have been all over the SEC from the minute I was fired until now. And then I went to the UK Serious Fraud Office, and the Serious Fraud Office called up the SEC and said, why don't you tell us what your plans are for bringing the World Bank into compliance? And I had met with the audit committee, and I told them they should order an external audit of something called internal controls. That means that when there's information to correct inaccurate financial information, that information is honored. And, of course, if you're firing lawyers who are correcting inaccurate financial statements, then you are out of compliance. And so I can answer your question about the Philippines right now. I was working in the Philippines, and there was corruption there. The man who was then the president was, he was just ripping off the country. And one of the World Bank projects was in the financial sector, the second largest bank in the Philippines. And there was a condition in the loan that bank was supposed to be sold. So what happened was the guy who owned Philippine Airlines, who was in default on his loans to Philippine National Bank, he ended up going to the employees and buying the employees' stock. And nobody wants to have their money on deposit in a bank which is controlled by a borrower who's in default on its loans. So the people in the Philippines, they took all their money out, and the Philippine government had to bail out the bank. And I had been warning the guy who was in charge of the Philippines that he had to, I gave him a letter. I said, sign this letter, send it to the government saying, dear government, you're not going to get your money on this loan because you're not following the conditions. And I had been working with a wonderful man who was like the father of the Philippines Constitution. And he was then the Chief Justice of the Philippine Supreme Court. And, you know, I'm still in touch with him. I'm still in touch with a lot of people that I know mm-hmm. from my time in the World Bank. In any event, what happened was there was a run on the bank, and then the World Bank Evaluation Department said we couldn't have foreseen what was going to happen. So the World Bank loan got canceled for $200 million. There was Japanese lending for $200 million. That's $400 million. And a run on the bank that the depositors have to be bailed out for $500 million. That's $900 million worth of problem. And the World Bank had a satisfactory performance. I said, you're out of your mind. So I studied economics in Holland, so I knew the man who was representing the Dutch government. And the two of us went and met with Jim Wolfensohn. And we said, there is a problem going on here. There's corruption in the Philippines. And the evaluation department is lying to the board. So Jim Wolfensohn's idea of solving the problem was to put me on probation.
Really?
So this is a cover-up. So we're starting with a cover-up, but, you know, a cover-up can go one of two ways. It can get resolved, or it can get further covered up. And what happened was when they threw me out of the World Bank without solving the cover-up, and the World Bank has all of these bonds on the capital markets, that means that we have Enron at the World Bank. And so I have been to every single country, 188 of them. I have written their ambassadors many times. I've written something called the National Advisory Council on International Monetary and Financial Policies. It's the acronyms are the NAC. And if you wanted to see what I said to them, and the people that are on the NAC, it's Ben Bernanke. It's the Secretary of the Treasury. It was Tim Geithner, and now it's Jack Lew. And it's the chairman of the SEC. So all of these people are on the hook for a cover-up. That's what my story is. My story is no longer about the World Bank. My story is about being very close to martial law, because when I had this lawsuit, instead of solving the problem, the courts, the same judges who gave their opinion on the what was going on in Guantanamo Bay, they got a little bit nervous because I wrote in a blog that the person who was working as the head of the legal department in the World Bank, and it's a whole other story how she got there that's involved with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, but we won't go there. I won't bore your listeners. But I said that this lawyer should not be managing the litigation against me. It should be managed by the board. And the next day after that, this panel of judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued an opinion, a secret opinion. And I have to say also what was going on during the litigation. One day when I had a filing deadline, my computer crashed and my brief was erased. And I complained about that to the FBI. I said, this is, you know, you can't have a serious country does not crash the litigation briefs the day before a filing deadline. In any event, the whole thing was just totally out of whack, totally out of whack. And so the judges issued a non-public opinion which said, if this lady tries to appeal this decision, and they didn't give any reason, they said, we like what the lower court decided, but when you're dismissing a case, you have to ignore what the lower court did. You have to do it, it's called de novo, as if nothing had been decided before. So they issued an illegal opinion. The only thing they took the trouble of writing was that my argument had been so frivolous that if I tried to appeal, they were going to slap me with the legal fees of the other parties. I was also suing KPMG because KPMG didn't follow the auditing standards. They circumscribed their audit. They wouldn't let me talk to their audit team and tell their audit team what I knew. So their audit of internal controls was not a proper audit. They had no right giving an unqualified legal opinion. So I was suing them as well. In any event, so you had this wacky decision. So I went to the various people that I've been in touch with for years, and I said, this is a very damaging opinion, and I think that we should just settle this case. I will accept whatever you want to give me, and let's just tell the court that we've settled the case. And we went back to the court and we said, this decision is no longer valid. We have settled the case. And the clerk ignored 188 ministers of finance. Ignored them. And so I went to something called the Judicial Conference, and I said, we have a problem here. The clerk doesn't understand 188 ministers of finance. And at the same time, I told the who's on this judicial conference, it's chaired by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But I've been also very much in touch with some of the other justices. There's something called the Raymond Aron Lecture, which is a lecture where the French government gets to talk about problems in its relationship with the United States. And the topic that they wanted to talk about was the internationalization of law. So I went to that lecture. That was on December 18th. And I spoke to Justice Breyer, who was there talking to the ambassador of France. And we talked about this problem. And I have kept these people briefed. At the same time, I have briefed the chief justices of all the state Supreme Courts that our clerk is ignoring the decision of 188 ministers of finance. That's nuts. What kind of a country are we? We're supposedly, if you follow the public opinion polls, 80% of our people want the United States to act with other countries on international affairs. We don't want to be a go-it-alone country. We don't want to be a scofflaw country. But that's what we are, and I cannot tell the American people that that's what we are, because these big boys own the press and won't get the story out. So the real story is not about corruption in the Philippines. The real story is about there is a lock on the news that go to the American people. They can't even find out when they're voting for president. They can't even find out about corruption of a man who's the national security advisor of one of the candidates.
So, Karen Hudis, I guess in the last few years, with what we've seen with the mortgage, right, going on, with the LIBOR scandal, now there is another one on the credit default swaps, similar, just as big as LIBOR, and the MF Global, right? And none of these people ever seem to get called, I mean, really pay, except they just pay a little bit of fines for them. It's not much, and then they go on their way. I mean, this is really rampant what's going on worldwide. I mean,
that's what I'm telling you about. These people think they're above the law, and I have written to them. I have written to them directly, and I have said, if you think I'm not going to get through, you better think again, and you are not above the law. And if you turn this around now while I'm talking to you, we'll be more lenient. And instead of listening, they're trying to throw me in jail. So I ask them, if they're listening to this broadcast, when they think they're going to start playing like human beings. They are just as subject to the law as anybody else.
So what is this with Eric Holder and your meeting on the 30th? What kind of official papers have you received, Karen Hudis?
Okay, I'll tell you what happened. During there were 3 days of meetings, April 19th, 20th, and 21st, and all of the countries of the world who want the United States to play by the rules, along with everybody else, issued me a pass to go into the meetings. And I did on the 19th. I spoke with various delegations. And then I sent them emails. And then on the 20th, when I went back to the meetings, I had a security pass issued to me by these countries because it's a co-op.
And
it's
where was
owned
this?
By these countries.
This was after?
And I went there, and the Secret Service wouldn't let me into the meetings. I said, why are you keeping me out? You have no right to keep me out. And so I went back. Well, I stayed on the periphery, and I called all of the different countries. I said, you know, this is kind of weird. Somebody thinks that they run the place and you don't. And then I sent a letter to the new director of the Secret Service, which I had cleared with all of the countries, and I said, whatever you think you're doing, it's illegal. So then what happened was they issued me something called a barring notice. It was signed by a little peon inside the World Bank who didn't have any legal authority. The World Bank is managed by the ministers of finance of 188 countries. And then it was issued on the paper, the letterhead of the D.C. government. So I called up the D.C. government and I said the person who signed that piece of paper did not have the authority to overrule 188 ministers of finance who are in control. This paper has no legal validity. And I wrote the commander of the D.C. Second Precinct, Michael Reese, and I said, if you think this is valid, I want you to call up the chairman of the Development Committee, Dr. Marek Belka, and I want you to call up the chairman of, or he's called the dean, of the executive board of the World Bank, Dr. Hassan, and I want you to ask them whether this paper is valid or whether it's not. I said, because I am going to the World Bank on Monday. If I'm not reinstated and we don't have rule of law, we're going to have a currency war that's going to make what happened in the 30s depression look like nothing. And, I mean, you can start to see some of it, what's going on in the markets. We are 2 weeks away from something called backwardation, permanent backwardation of gold. That's where people don't trust dollars anymore. Why should they trust dollars when you don't have confidence in the Secretary of the Treasury? Because the Secretary of the Treasury is cooking the books. He gave the Inspector General, the Auditor General, gave a fake audit on gold when Germany asked for its gold back. Why do you think Germany asked for its gold back? Because the U.S. is no longer credible. It's not playing by the rules. It's a scofflaw. It's an outlaw nation. And if I am being victimized when they know who I am, I'm their lawyer. I have been trying to get the United States to play by the rules, and all of the governors know that. So what you have is you have a situation where the governors know that I am talking about rule of law. We have a constitutional law crisis in this country, which is every bit as close as what happened during the Civil War, when the states know that their federal government is out of whack. That's where we are. We are in an emergency state.
And the governors, you traveled to each one of the states, Karen Hudis, and talked to the governors about your concerns?
No, what I did was I mailed all of them in December a letter. And I live in Maryland, and I got a letter back from my governor. There's also something called the National Governors Association, and I went to that meeting, and I spoke personally with the president of the National Governors Association, Jack Markell, and I have kept him and his legal team briefed, very detailed about what's going on. And the other day, I called up the governor of Texas to tell him about what was going on where they're trying to throw me in jail on the 30th of May. So, yes, I'm in touch with individual governors, and I'm in touch with the president of the National Governors Association, and I'm faxing them and emailing them and talking to their offices on a daily basis.
What kind of case is the Justice Department alleging that they have against you, Karen Hudis?
Okay, what happened was they had this barring notice, which was not legal because the person who signed it on behalf of the World Bank could not overrule 188 ministers of finance. And so I went there on Monday having told Commander Michael Reese that I was going there, and I said, if you don't think I should be there legally, let me know. And he didn't let me know. So I went there, and the next thing I knew, one of his policemen had me handcuffed and threw me in jail. And ordered me to criminal court on the 30th of May. That's what it is. And I'm looking at that barring notice, and, you know, I'm happy to give you a copy of it. And when it says, who's going to be prosecuting me, it's Eric Holder. Now, first of all, I wasn't trespassing. I was legally authorized to be there. The people who run the place want me there. They've reinstated me. So there is no trespass. So what are the charges? I have no clue. I'm clueless. But I can tell you this. Somebody who's a very good writer offered to write up my case. And in my case, what did she put in there? She put in there that if I go to jail, I'm obviously going to be killed. I said, oh, that's interesting. Don't you think it's a little melodramatic? I'm being threatened.
Okay, Karen Yudis is our guest. Pretty wow stuff. This currency war thing, it's really happening now, isn't it, Karen Yudis? I mean, all of the central banks are printing and you know, are creating money in kind of in unison now, the euro and the yen and everybody's creating more dollars and creating more currencies.
Yeah, what happens in a currency war is countries think that they're going to sell more goods if their currency is a little bit cheaper, so they devalue, and then the other countries match that, and, you know, it's kind of like a poker game. I see your bid, I match you. And so you have a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
That's one of the, and you know, we've seen a little bit of that. But I'm very optimistic, actually. This stakeholder analysis is 90 to 95% accurate. It's been very much on track. And I really do think we're going to avoid this currency war. All we have to do is end this cover-up in the United States and admit that our press is owned lock, stock, and barrel by these very powerful economic players, and that they're filtering the information to our people, and you can't have that in a democracy. They cannot block information. Who gave them the censor pen that people shouldn't hear about what's really happening? No. I'm starting to get a lot of hits on my website and my YouTube, and it went viral. And then what was interesting is the counter broke on my YouTube video. All kinds of funny things happened. But I really do believe that people are able to work together, to pull together. I think this is a strong country, and I'm very, very grateful for getting this opportunity, Patrick. This is why I wanted to go on sooner rather than later, to get the word out sooner. And I think
people
are starting to catch on to what I have to say. It all matches up. I mean, some people say it sounds so horrible they can't believe it, and then they go to my website and they see this massive correspondence. When you go to Yale Law School, you know how to document. I've got a chronology. You can see all the letters I've written and some of the letters that I've gotten back and my testimony that's up on the UK Parliament website. You can't fake that kind of stuff. This is for real,
but
folks.
As an attorney, Ms. Hudes, it has to be concerning, or is it concerning to you that you may not even really have a real place to argue with the courts the way they are, and, you know, it's just, I mean, it's there's no real, well, I mean, you just don't know if you're going to get anything fair in any court these days, do you?
Well,
I mean,
don't forget, we've got a federal system of government, and we've got state courts. And I think those are, you know, our state governments are going to stand by us and help us through this, clean up this mess. It's just a mess. It's nothing more than a mess. Our country is strong. Our people are strong. We're good people, and we'll straighten it out. That's all. We'll straighten it out, and there won't be a currency war. I'm not here. I mean, one of the things that concerns me, you know, I've made my way through the alternate media, and there are so many doom and gloom people telling everybody, you know, to batten down the hatches, that, you know, there's going to be, you got to take to the streets. No, that's not necessary. We do have laws. We do have a strong government. It's at the state level. It's at the local level. And the federal level, we will straighten those people out. We will straighten them out.
Well, I think you're right there. There's been so many very positive things that have gone on with the county sheriffs around the country with this whole gun control thing. They've essentially stopped it, you know, because of a lot of the governors.
That's right. This is all very positive. What's happening right now is actually very positive. I mean, I don't want your listeners to say, oh my goodness, this is just such a horrible story. It's not a horrible story. I have been helped by so many different people. I have been just so gratified by what's going on. Don't worry. We're fine.
It's just, it is concerning, though, when the mainstream media, as you said, I think there's evidence that goes back, Andrew Tartus, Karen Hudis, that the Rothschild enterprise, they were buying things like the Associated Press, the United Press International, back in the 20s.
They are a bunch of bullies and crooks, and we don't have to listen to the garbage that they put out there for us. We can go to the internet and we can find out what's really going on, and people can listen to you, Patrick, and they can sort things through. They can figure out that they're being given a bunch of malarkey by these bullies.
Tell us just before we go a bit about what you experienced in Congress. That has to be discouraging, I guess, in some stance when you think that you have people there that are supposed to help and are not?
Look, don't forget, Senator Lugar wrote 3 letters on my behalf before I was fired. There was a GAO inquiry, Government Accountability Office inquiry. That was Senators Lugar, Leahy, and Bayh. I spoke to Senator Hagel at the time when, by the way, I've been in touch with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on all of this.
Really?
Oh, of course I have. What happened was, don't forget, I've got this very accurate stakeholder analysis tool. And I wrote to the Inspector General after Secretary Hagel was appointed, and I said, Secretary Hagel needs to get active on this because we are making the currency markets very uncomfortable with all of this turmoil because it's taking us too long to get this problem under control. And after I did that, I got LinkedIn, there's this network. Mm-hmm. I got a request from LinkedIn by the person inside the Department of Defense who had been working on this stakeholder analysis inside the Department of Defense. And I said, you know how accurate this stakeholder analysis is. We've got to clean up this corruption now before don't forget, Germany asked for its gold back and we denied Germany its gold. That's illegal. That's the stuff that currency wars are made of. Instead of giving Germany their gold, we gave them a piece of paper signed by the Office of the Inspector General and the Treasury Department. Don't forget, those people were the same ones that were covering up the problem in the Philippines. Their paper is not very trustworthy. So the Germans, they said, I don't like this paper audit. The paper audit had 4 pages worth of, the fine line that you write under the guarantee, you can rely on it. Well, so Germany read this audit of their gold, and they said, we'd rather have our gold back, thank you. And then the U.S. said, well, we'll give it to you when we're good and ready in 7 years. It's Germany's gold. If Germany asks for their gold back, they get it back. Okay? So so Secretary Hagel knows that this is a huge problem. What happens if Germany pulls out of NATO? You can't have that. So I sort of changed the subject.
No, no, that's
getting back
right.
to Congress.
That's right.
I have been to the Joint Economic Committee. There are 2 different proposals coming out of the Joint Economic Committee. One of them is very good. It says, let's increase the capital requirement on these mega banks.
Mm-hmm.
That's one proposal. There's a second proposal, which is not so good. That's Congressman Brady's proposal. That's, we should declare that it's legal for the Fed to manipulate the price of gold. Did you ever hear anything so wacky in your life?
Well, it's they're doing it now. I mean, the people that own the Fed are doing it.
Yes, but it's illegal, and Kevin Brady's giving them a pass.
Oh, I see.
Okay, but anyway, so Congress, don't forget, Congress is the one that put the law in there that said there has to be a condition of disbursement for the World Bank capital increase that whistleblowers have to be made whole. So it's a mixed bag.
What do you think about if they want to... Isn't there somebody, one of the congresspeople, Karen Hudis, that wants to reinstate Glass-Steagall?
Yeah, there are. I'm just saying, what you really need for Congress to function properly is you need a well-informed citizenry. And when the press is strangled by these big boys, as you call them, then you don't have that. So the problem with Congress is not so much Congress, it's the fact that we have no free press.
Sure. And then the people, they don't really get an idea, and so they can make a decision on what's right and what's wrong.
They can't judge.
No, they can't judge because they don't get a, they don't see it.
They don't get a fair crack at it.
They don't see anything, no. Hey, it's tough, boy. So that must have been interesting. Some of the bigger outfits that you went to, what kind of, did this ignore you, like New York Times and those kind of places?
Okay, there's in Washington, there's something called the Newseum. It's a big, beautiful museum. It's been built by these people. And you go in there and you wander the corridors and you say, oh, yeah, freedom of the press, isn't that wonderful? And, you know, there's a whole big room about the Pentagon Papers, and you say, oh, isn't it wonderful to live in a country where there's freedom of the press?
Mm.
And I have been all over those people. If you go to my website, you'll see something with a button which says media. If you push on that button, you'll see my correspondence with those people. I said, if this is such a free press, don't you think the people in the country have a right to know what's going on with their constitution when their chief justice is ignoring 188 ministers of finance and this will end the country in a ditch? Don't you think this is newsworthy?
Well, Sharon has put up your a video that you did with someone, not sure who, I'm sorry, Karen Huditz exposes the World Bank. We put that on the front page.
People, oh, thank you.
People can
thank
watch
you.
That and pass on this link to everyone that you care about. And how could you, what, how could our listeners support you and your mission moving forward? And then before we say goodbye, how could they help you if they want
to? They should write their congresspeople and tell them to ask Eric Holder to stop, to get serious. To get the FBI to look into who's been doing crazy things. So, for example, when you were sending me the request to confirm this this slot, I didn't get those emails.
Mm.
Somebody's breaking the law with my emails. I want the FBI to do the real job, and I want Eric Holder to do his real job, which is to uphold this country's constitution and not the big boys. He's confused about who he really works for.
Well, you know, with all due respect to Eric Holder, he may need his own attorney soon if he keeps going the way he's going.
Well, I want your listeners to give him a piece of, I want your listeners to give him a piece of their mind.
Okay. All right, Ms. Huditz, thanks you so much for being there. Best of luck to you. And
thank you.
Take care of yourself.